This is Mae Warren. Today is the 15th of April, 1996. I'm in Charlottesville, Virginia with Dr. Edgar Shannon. And I'm intrigued by, we've been talking about being an administrator and being president of colleges, because one of the things I just realized as I was driving over here is that you grew up on the campus of Washington and Lee, right?
That's right.
So did you know Henry Louis Smith?
Oh, yeah.
I've been reading lots and lots of things by Henry Louis Smith just in the last few weeks, and I'm fascinated by him.
Yeah.
And so it's exciting to me to think that you actually knew him.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me your impressions of him?
Well, of course, I suppose he was... I was fairly young. I was born in 1918, and moved into the house, what's now called the Lee Jackson House, next door to the President's House. My father and mother moved in there when I was two. So I lived in that house from the time I was two until I was 20. When my father died, he died in May of 1939, of 38, excuse me, a year before, really at the end of my junior year. And so I lived next door. So my first memories are knowing Dr. and Ms. Smith and some of his children. His children were all older than I was. I guess the youngest two boys were Norris and Frank, and I think Frank was the youngest. And I think Frank must have probably, by the time I was taking things in, you know, when I was eight or nine or something, I think Frank must have probably been a teenager, must have been 16 or something like that. I don't know the exact ages, but I should guess he was six or seven years older than I was. So, Dr. Smith, I guess, died, and he was, I think he was thrown out of a car in an automobile and got a concussion, and I think never recovered from it. I think that's...
I haven't gotten that far yet, so I don't know that.
Yeah,
I can't confirm or deny.
Yeah, I think that was the reason for his death. But anyway, I'm pretty sure Dr. Gaines came in 1930.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
And so I think he was probably... Dr. Smith died in 29 or early 30 anyway. So I was 12 by the time he died, so I was old enough to know him. But he was very dignified by that time. He was a very dignified sort of white-haired man, and very courtly, and I was in and out of the house over there quite a bit. And of course, I'd always see him as I did Dr. Gaines, walking back and forth from the Lee house and across the campus, you know, in front of our house, going over to the colonnade to their offices. And I suppose he was kind of legendary for quotations that he tended to exaggerate, and was known for exaggeration. He recognized it himself, and there's a story about him that maybe you've come upon, that he used to have chapel, and he was talking in chapel, and he said, "Now, young gentlemen," he said, "beware of exaggeration. It's a very bad trait." And he said, "My dear young chaps, I have wept bushels of tears over that very same subject."
That's great.
And he was a Phi Delta Theta, and his sons, at least Norris and Frank and I guess it started with Raymond. Raymond was the eldest, I think. Anyway, they all became betas, and someone asked him how he felt about his sons being betas, and he said, the Phi Deltas didn't have too good a reputation at that time, apparently. Said, "Oh, I'd much rather my sons would be godly betas than drunken, carousing Phi Delta Thetas." At any rate, he was considered something of a character, but very, you know, highly regarded, highly respected, very fine man.
Well, the period I've been reading about, he just seems to have an answer for everything. He's sending out these proclamations to the universe,
mm-hmm.
and telling people why they should be moral people and why they should do the right
mm-hmm.
thing. And it just, it's so unlike a modern president. And
mm-hmm.
I'm kind of intrigued and charmed by it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered if he was like that in person. Was he constantly emoting little sermons? Because mm-hmm. that seems to be what he was doing in writing.
A great deal, I suppose so. But of course, from childhood to 12, I really didn't see much
mm-hmm.
Of that that side. Though he, of course, he came from a very, I guess, a very strong Presbyterian family. I guess one of his brothers was a Presbyterian minister in Little Rock, very well known Presbyterian minister in Little Rock, and then his brother, Alfonso Smith, was an English professor. Was actually the Edgar Allan Poe professor of English here at the University of Virginia. And when Josephus Daniels became Secretary of the Navy under Woodrow Wilson, he asked him to come to head the English and humanities department at the Naval Academy. So Josephus Daniels brought civilians into the Naval Academy to improve the quality of instruction, and that's continued ever since. The other two academies have only military faculty, but the Navy has a considerable civilian faculty and Alfonso Smith had a whole, his brother Alfonso had a whole series of grammar school textbooks. So I grew up on something like fifth and sixth grade textbooks written by C. Alfonso Smith.
Oh.
And I still remember the example in the book, the difference between the active and the passive voice, and the active is Marat stabbed Charlotte Corday. The passive was Charlotte Corday was stabbed by Marat from the French Revolution.
Yes.
So I guess I can't. I say, really, my recollections of him are more anecdotal and also just being generally aware of him, but not old enough to have heard much of his prognostications or his tending to preach. But of course, there was just a lot more of that in the air. For example, in this thing about my father, that he's an elder in the Presbyterian Church and deeply interested in moral training of those under his care, you know, and I think that's true. I think there was a lot of emphasis even in my day about the importance of character and developing character, and I think that still persists at Washington Lee in the honor system, but you still don't hear much. I mean, that's talked about very much, but in general, I think you don't hear talk in general or exhortations about character and morals that in the same way you did 50 years ago, say.
Were you aware of the honor system as you grew up on campus? Was it talked
about?
Oh, yeah, sure. Tell me about that.
Well, I mean, it was just the ethos was very much there, and symbolized and talked about that. Students left books all over the campus. They'd be going downtown or something, they'd leave books just by the gate there, by the Episcopal Church, not by the gate, but the opening of the fence there, you know, they'd dump books there and walk on downtown and so on. And so there was a lot of emphasis on how open everything was. You didn't lock your door in the dormitory or anything of that sort. So it was very, very much in the air. And then of course living there right on the campus and right next to the dormitories, students were from the time I can remember, students were around. I used to go out and watch as they were pitching baseballs behind the dormitory and so on. And as I got a little older, the students were always awfully nice to me, and they'd get you throw the balls with you and throw footballs and things like that. So I grew up sort of playing with the students to some extent. And then I had relatives who were cousins who were at Washington Lee who would drop into the house and talk with my father and mother, about what was going on. The honor system was just present all the time. So I really grew up with it. And then we had an honor system. I went 2 years to Lexington High School. We had an honor system there, and also at Darlington School where I went. I was president of the honor council at Darlington, and then came to Washington Lee. So it was very, very natural part of life when I came to Washington Lee. And then I was my senior year. I was vice president of the student body and on the executive committee. So I had a long experience with it.
Now, what was that experience, being on the executive committee, like? Did you have any cases that were particularly difficult?
We didn't have a large number, but we had. It was you felt it as a very grave responsibility. And. And of course, we had the tradition that that as soon as a charge was made, you dropped everything and followed it through. So that I remember particularly the last one that I was on was involved a classmate who was a senior, and within. It happened in exams, he was just within days of graduation. Mm-hmm. And he was charged with cheating on a test, and somebody said he'd seen him some, but the to some, and that he was turning, he had some kind of material and was turning his pages in a notebook back and forth and copying from this thing. So we had an eyewitness, but but the question was, it still lacked evidence and proof. And kind of ironically, one of his fraternity brothers was the junior representative on the honor committee, and he said, well, let me go down to the house and check on it. And he went down to the Pike house and came back with a notebook that had leaves of some of the of some text. Torn out or cut out and interleaved in this ring notebook. Mm-hmm. And so this tied in with the examination. Of course, the professor had provided his examination book, so it was clear he was copying his stuff out. So it was an open and shut case, but it was very, it was sad because you didn't think this person really needed to cheat. He was probably going to graduate anyway. He may not have got a very good grade, but he probably would have graduated. And to do that after 4 years at Washington Lee just seemed to be unbelievable. And then it was tough for a fraternity brother essentially to convict him. On the other hand, this was remarkable evidence of the honor code taking precedence over other loyalties. It was the supreme loyalty.
What happened to that person? What happens to someone when a violation, when they have, is it a conviction? I mean, would you call it a conviction?
Well, in that case, the committee is satisfied, and the chairman of the honor committee simply gets in touch with the person and tells him he has to leave the university within 24 hours. I don't know how they do it now, but that's what they used to do.
And when he leaves, what happens to his records? Can he then transfer to another school?
Well, I don't know what, since he was so close to graduation, I don't know what he ever did, whatever happened. Most people do transfer to other schools, and certainly here at the University of Virginia, we have almost a completely successful record of people who have been convicted going on to other universities. But I'm sure I don't know what's done right now, but I'm sure in those days it was on your transcript. It went on your transcript that the person had been separated from the university for violation of the honor system. I don't know what they do now, and I think it still goes on your transcript here. The law has got so tricky on a lot of these things now. I don't know whether it still goes on the transcript or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly an impressive system. It brings a lot of pleasure to me to be in a place where you can trust people.
Yeah, it really does. And and of course you had, but generally that was the procedure. I think then, of course, there is a provision that you can appeal the honor, the executive committee's decision to a public trial. And those come up from time to time. There was one public trial when I was not on the committee. It was when I was a sophomore. It was the first one that had occurred in years. And they had a public trial in the old auditorium in Washington Hall. That's before it had been remodeled and had the president's office in. The way it is now, and there was a large auditorium on the second floor in the front of Washington Hall, and matter of fact, that's where the lectures my father used to for the sophomore English class, which was a history of English literature, and he used to lecture one period. We went 3 days a week in those days. He used to lecture one period, and then I think all the other members of the department had sections of the class that had 25 or 30 in them that met for the other 2 days for discussion groups, and you wrote a theme a week in that one. Well, anyway, they had the trial in this in that auditorium. You know, they selected a random jury and had some law students as judge and prosecutor and defender and all, and had a whole setup of trial very much in accordance with normal court procedures. And it was a day-long trial, and it was open. I don't think I remember going and listening to it. I don't think I think people came and went because of classes and so on. I don't remember being there for the whole trial, but actually they cleared this person. The honor committee had convicted him, but on the public trial he was cleared, and he left the university. He didn't. It was in the spring sometime. He finished the year, I think. Didn't come back, but anyway, he was cleared. But that was kind of extraordinary and memorable. There have been others since then, but I think that was the first one since, oh, something like 1905 or something of that sort.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you were able to witness that.
Yeah.
Because that is pretty extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
I made a note a few minutes ago that I'd like to pursue, I mean, maybe a dead-end street, but it seems like there's a real connection, at least at that time period, between Arkansas and Washington and Lee. Because President Denny left, Dr. Smith's predecessor left Washington and Lee to go to Arkansas in, I believe, 1912. And then your father comes in 1914 from Arkansas, right?
You know, Dr. Denny went to Alabama. He didn't go to Arkansas.
Oh, Alabama. That's right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. All right. All right. So forget, there's no Arkansas.
Well, there used to be a fairly strong connection, at least of students who came from Arkansas to Washington Lee. And my father had at least two, I think. Yeah, he had two first cousins who came to Washington Lee from Little Rock before he came. And my father had two first cousins, Ross McCain and Arthur McCain, who both graduated from Washington Lee while he was still at the University of Arkansas, and then he had another first cousin who came as a student after he was at Washington Lee, and then he had another first cousin once removed who was a student in Sam McCain, they were all McCains, who was again from Little Rock, who was I guess he graduated in I think he graduated in 20 I think in 27, he was a Rhodes Scholar from Washington Lee, the second Rhodes Scholar from Washington Lee. So there were a lot of family Arkansas connections with Washington and Lee, and then there used to be a pretty steady stream of students from Arkansas. So, interesting, my father and both my mother and father's family were really originally from Virginia, and had my middle name is Finley, and there are a lot of Finleys over in Augusta County. My mother's family were here, and some of hers were here in Albemarle County, and my original Shannon ancestors. The Shannons came. They were originally a sept of the MacDonald clan. Came over to Northern Ireland. Lived in the Ulster area of Northern Ireland for about 100 years, and then came, probably landed at Newcastle, Delaware, in about 1845, and settled in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And my ancestor Thomas Shannon came down here to Albemarle, and was one. My mother had an ancestor, and my Thomas Shannon were both on the first Board of Board of Justices of Amherst County when it was cut off from Albemarle County. And then then Thomas Shannon had a brother, William Shannon, who went out to Kentucky, and he became Quartermaster and Commissary General under George Rogers Clark in the Northwest in the Revolution, and then he settled in Kentucky and was in the Virginia legislature briefly, and then was in the first Kentucky legislature when it was cut off from Virginia, about 1890, I guess, 1790, 1991. And so he kind of called the rest of the family and said, you know, come on out to Kentucky. It's God's country out here. So my ancestor moved on out there, and my mother's family got out to Kentucky. And then so my father grew up in Kentucky, and then after, but that was after the Civil War, of course, but my mother's father sold his land in Kentucky and went to Arkansas after the Civil War. And my father was teaching at the University of Arkansas, and my mother was in one of his classes at the University of Arkansas, so that's how they met. But it was rather interesting, and then he did have a woman first cousin who was married to Frank Moore in Lexington, who was a Washington League graduate, of course, was a lawyer there in Lexington for a long time, and lived on Jordan Street, and I guess the family still own that house. At any rate, that's really how my father got to Washington Lee. That
through that connection,
his cousin living was Mrs. Moore, cousin Lois, was living there in Lexington, and they knew Dr. Curl was retiring, and so they, anyway, alerted my father and alerted Washington Lee, and it all worked out. So we got back. We were originally from Virginia and went through Kentucky to Arkansas and got back here.
And right back home.
And I was born within about 75 miles, I guess, of where most of my ancestors had been a few 150 years earlier, something like that.
That seems, again, distant, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, tell me about growing up on campus. What was it like on campus at Washington and Lee in the 20s?
Well, it was...
Who were the people you interacted with? What was the atmosphere?
Well, it was a very pleasant atmosphere on the whole. I grew up, I've got a picture I surely should pull out and show you. I used to ride my kiddie car on the sidewalks when I was just big enough to move around. I used to ride my kiddie car down in front of the, down the hill and down in front of the R.E. Lee Church, and later, of course, as I got larger, I had a tricycle, and then I had a bicycle, and really we used to those walks on the campus. You see I'm not sure all the roads were even paved in town in those days. I know all out where Ferris lives and all out that way was all dirt roads, and so a lot of the young people my age, particularly when we were just about 12 and 10 to 12, 14, something like that, after school used to congregate on the W&L campus and ride bicycles around. And it got to be, I guess, so many of us that we got to be a nuisance. And Mr. Peenick, who was then the treasurer and looked after buildings and grounds and so on, came down with an edict that we couldn't ride bicycles on the campus anymore. But of course, and by that time, I'm sure by the latter part of it, I remember the streets were paved, and I used to ride a bicycle around town on the streets quite a bit. And of course, the traffic wasn't anything like it is now. And of course, you never thought about helmets or anything of that sort. But I suppose the students were always walking back and forth certainly in the daytime, not much in the afternoon. The meal situation in those days was that everyone had the big meal. Dinner was in the middle of the day, and the college schedule ran till 2 o'clock. All the classes ran till 2 o'clock, and then everybody had dinner at 2 o'clock, and then the afternoon was free. There were no afternoon classes. The afternoon was free for athletics and that sort of thing. But the whole town was really on that schedule. You had, and then you just had supper at night. You didn't have a big meal at night. And but usually had supper about 6 o'clock, and fraternities had a meal at 6 o'clock. And then the but my real one of my experiences particularly was well, let me go back. I'm wandering around here, but you saw the students walking back and forth all the time, and of course we had the old speaking tradition where everyone spoke to everyone else. So whether you knew them or not, but Washington Lee was small enough. We held it to I guess 900. I think it was 900, maybe 950 when I was in college, but I'm sure it was a bit smaller, probably only about 800, something like that, when I was growing up. So most all the students knew each other by name, at any rate. And so there was a friendly atmosphere. I guess the students all wore freshman caps. The freshmen wore caps. You had a little, sort of a little beanie, a little blue cap, sort of like a baseball cap, but it didn't have anything like the visor that you have in a baseball cap now. Just a tiny little visor and then a cap to wear in the back of your head with a white button on it. And I think it had W&L on on the front of it. And you had to wear that as a student, a freshman, you had to wear that your first term. So the freshmen were all identified, and we had an assimilation committee that if you were smart alecky or didn't speak or things like that, you got called up for the assimilation committee and got paddled. And
literally
paddled. And then the second term, you had a sailor hat, which was a dark blue sailor hat with a white band around it, and you wore this sailor hat about halfway through the second term, I guess, and then you finally got rid of your identification as a freshman. And but that's jumping over a little bit. But my particular experience growing up on it, well, it was what made me think of this. But and everybody wore hats then too. I mean, if you wore these caps as a freshman, but everybody else wore a regular felt hat. And So when the snow was on the ground, we were really, I can't remember who the other culprits were, but at least there were some kids my age, say when we were about 8 or 9, when it snowed, we used to throw snowballs at the students' hats. And as they came, we'd get up there on the bank just as they came into the campus. Right by the Episcopal Church, get up on that bank and throw snowballs at them and then run away. But we weren't very damaging. I don't think we ever really hit a hat, maybe once. And but my special experience was that I had a pony. My uncle, my father sort of believed from Kentucky days that a boy couldn't grow up without a horse, and I had an uncle out in Arkansas who, my mother's brother, who had a farm out in Arkansas, and he was raising a few ponies just for fun. He just liked them, and he had a purebred Shetland pony that was, was a stud pony and was raising some. And I was out there to visit. Mother and I went out there to visit, I think, when probably I was about 5, and he had a colt that he said he was going to send me when he got the colt broken and so on. But after about a year, when the colt would have been old enough to be sent to me, I guess, he decided he was a little, he didn't like his temperament, thought his temperament wasn't quite right. And so anyway, by the time I was 7, He had the stud gelded. He was a wonderful pony. He was actually he was a purebred Shetland, had bloodlines that were registered, and had already been named before my uncle got him, Marshall Foch. So his name was Foch, and he was flax chestnut pony with flax mane and tail. And he had a wonderful disposition, and so he sent me this pony when I was seven, and from Arkansas, and I wasn't really old enough to handle him properly. But in those days, the campus wasn't groomed and kept up the way it is now, and then there was just lots of tall grass around the edges, and even the grass didn't get cut that often on the campus itself. So, and living in that house, the Lee Jackson house, we had a pretty good sizable backyard and a high privet hedge. There's still a privet hedge there, but it's only about chest high now, but this used to be up 7 or 8 feet. So it was a pretty completely private backyard. So I kept the pony in the backyard a good deal of the time, and then at night, particularly in the summertime, and of course we had no summer school of any kind in those days, I just drive a stake in the ground with a rope and stake him out on various parts of the campus to graze while overnight. But I guess my first 2 or 3 years we had him probably when 7, 8 until I was 9. I think we probably, and certainly in the winter, we always boarded him out on a farm. But from the time I was 9 till I was 13, I think, I had that pony and just really kept him on the campus from May, something like May till October. And
where did you ride him?
Well, as they say in those days, all the roads, the minute you got out of town, except for US 11, were not paved. They were, and weren't even gravel. They were just dirt roads, and they were marvelous for riding. He had very hard hooves. So that, I wasn't riding him that hard at first. So that I guess for a couple of years, and we never even shot him, never even put horseshoes on him. But he, when I got to riding him a good deal and getting out on the roads a lot, we did put shoes on his front hooves, but never had him on his hind hooves. And used to ride on the VMI parade ground quite a bit. You can gallop up and down on the parade ground. And then I had one other friend who was 2 years older than I was, who got a, I guess by the time I was about 10, he got a small horse. And then we later had another friend who had a horse, and but with this friend with a small horse, Souther Tompkins, he's graduated from Washington, also has been a orthopedist. He's retired now, but in Oklahoma City for many, many years. At any rate, we used to ride regularly and take long rides out in the country on the country roads. And but this horse, this pony, he had a wonder. I think he really had a sense of humor, and I can remember so much. And I rode him bareback so much of the time in the summer, and I can remember riding him bareback on the VMI parade ground. Well, a lot, but I can remember from time to time I would inadvertently slide up a little forward up on his withers I wasn't comfortable to him to be quite that far up over his and I'd be galloping on over his shoulders and his forefeet, and he never bucked. And I don't think he ever kicked me but once. I think one time somewhere again I inadvertently tickled his flank some way in currying him or something, and he kicked out with one foot. But that's the only time I ever remember his kicking. So he had an excellent disposition. Some ponies have sort of mean disposition, but he had excellent. Anyway, he would just stop, and I'd go right over his shoulder. He didn't buck to throw me. I just would. He'd stop, and I'd fall over, slide over his shoulder. I would be hanging on, so I wouldn't go anywhere. And I would fall right down under his feet. He'd stop, dead stop, so he didn't step on me. And then would just stand there and kind of nuzzle me, like, "What the heck are you doing down there?" And then I guess I was visiting an uncle up in Erie, Pennsylvania, uncle and aunt up in Erie, Pennsylvania, and they had a summer place out on the lake from their thing, and they said, "You know, I think we've got a pony cart up in the attic in the barn out there." So we went out and looked at this pony cart, and they did. It was a very nice pony cart that needed a little bit of paint and repair, but they sent me this pony cart. So I had a pony cart, and it was a little big for him, but folks could handle it all right. And and it didn't take any problem breaking him to pulling the cart. So I had him in the pony with his pony cart, and used to drive him around town a lot with his pony cart. And I remember I used to, when I was something like 12 or so, I had a crush on a girl that lived out on Sellers Avenue, and I used to drive my pony cart out to, and everyone was, and there were other children that sort of collect around the pony cart, and I'd give them rides up and down Sellers Avenue in the pony cart.
Now, were there many other children on campus?
Yeah, they were. I think I was sort of in between the Smith children were a bit older, and so Dr. Camel had a couple of sons. The younger one was several years older than I was, but then there were quite a few children down in the down the hollow, down below the chapel, you know, Charlie McDowell and the Bean Boys, and those I remember particularly. I can't remember for sure, but there were quite a few that say were about 4 or 5 years younger than I were. They were growing up down there, and you saw some of them, but all that levels out when you get up toward teenage, but you know, when you're children, if you're, if you're 12 and somebody's 7, you're not really, you're aware of them, but you're not really playing with them very much. And talking about 7, I remember my 7th birthday. We had a baseball. I had a birthday party. It was a baseball party, and we had about, I don't know, it must have been a fairly good sized group. I think we had about 15 people for the party, and played baseball out between what's now the Commerce School and the Morris House.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like much room in there now, but that building wasn't quite as big as it is now. That was the old library, and we played baseball out there and had a marvelous time. Of course, it wasn't very good baseball at 7 years old, but we thought it was terrific. And I guess I had was a boy named George Barton. His father was a professor at VMI, and taught Latin and Greek at VMI, and lived in one of those houses that's just on the bend going down to Gaines Hall now, which is, there are about three houses in there, and they lived in the last one, I think, the last one that's still there next to Gaines Hall. And so, and we, we played a lot together when we were, you know, in the, particularly when we were about third grade age. What would that be? I guess in those days that was, I guess we were about eight, something like that. We were pretty much inseparable. Uh-huh. And so he was not on the campus, but he was right nearby, and we played on the campus a lot.
You need to turn my tape over.
Sure.
Just a moment.